Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. New York and Florida have been going in different directions on the coronavirus. In Florida, one of the states seeing increased coronavirus infections, the number of cases has doubled over the past 2 days, with over 4,000 daily cases now being reported. It's about 500 a day now in New York. It was over 10,000. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis plans to step up social distancing enforcement, saying the acceleration in positive tests cannot be chalked up to increased testing. That changes his tune from last week and separates him now from President Trump, who, of course, says more cases is because of more testing. DeSantis originally blamed the rise on more robust testing. In one effort to curb the spread, the Palm Beach County Board of Commissioners voted unanimously in favor of a mask requirement on Tuesday, much to the chagrin of some residents who voiced their opposition to the rule. Here's what one of them had to say at the hearing.
You literally cannot mandate somebody to wear a mask knowing that that mask is killing people. It literally is killing people. And we the people, are waking up, and we know what citizens' arrest is, because citizens' arrests are already happening, okay? And every single one of you that are obeying the devil's laws are going to be arrested. And you, doctor, are going to be arrested for crimes against humanity.
All right, then. Well, that resident may be in a small minority, at least in putting it that way. An ABC News Ipsos poll out today finds 89% of Americans say they're wearing masks. I guess they are all part of the devil's work. Joining me now to talk more about the situation in New York and the situation in Florida as they head in opposite directions, at least for the moment, is biostatistician and professor of biostatistics at the University of Florida, Professor Natalie Dean. Dr. Dean, thank you so much for some time today. I know you're crazy busy. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for having me.
So what do you make of Governor DeSantis acknowledging a need to step up social distancing and kind of changing his tune?
It's very important to recognize that what we're seeing in the numbers is not just attributable to testing. Of course, increases in testing are good and that can change how the numbers sort of appear. But the fact that we're also seeing at the same time other changes, like a higher percentage of tests are coming back positive, and we're hearing sort of anecdotes about hospitals starting to fill up a bit in certain areas, all of these signs together point to a real indication that there's a brewing problem.
Can you talk about the hospitals as you see them? Because one of the things that we hear a lot is that what makes Florida and Texas and some of the other states with spikes in cases now different from New York a couple of months ago is that the hospitalizations are not going up with the cases, and the deaths are not going up with the number of cases in the ways that they did in New York. What are you seeing?
So there are important lags that we have to remember occur from the time that someone is infected till the time that they get sick enough to require hospitalization, and then certainly to the time that people die. So there are, Arizona, for example, comes up as a state where we saw a real sharp increase in the numbers, and now we're hearing really a lot about hospitals starting to fill up in Arizona. So there are these lags that we forget about. There also is probably a genuine shift in who is getting infected. And so if it's more young people being infected, then we're not going to see the same dramatic increase in hospitalizations. But what can happen when a lot of young people are infected? Well, some of them, a small fraction of them will go on to get very sick. We know that they're not they're still susceptible to serious outcomes, small number. But also those people live in communities and they can go on to spread to other people within their communities. So we're starting to see in some states that it's the number of infections in older people, it lags behind, but it's increasing as well.
there was a two-week quarantine requirement for anybody coming from New York to Florida for a while. Now, New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut have imposed a two-week quarantine requirement for anyone coming from Florida and the other new high case count states. Do you support that policy? Do you think that's a good way to actually control infections here in the New York area, or is it more political and symbolic?
I wonder how much people, politicians even really understand. There seems to be the use of these quarantine policies hasn't been great. It seems to lag behind reality to a degree. I mean, we saw this early on in the epidemic when there was, you know, there were restrictions coming from China, but there were no restrictions for people coming from Europe, where when we knew that there was a raging epidemic in Italy and Spain. And I think, you know, there's no real precedent for having these types of restrictions going between states. So the policies I don't find to be that effective, just because there's just transmission within the we're still at a point where there's a level of transmission within our communities that is swamping kind of whatever is happening from travel. So I'm not sure the best way to implement those policies, but right now they don't seem so effective.
Listeners, we can take your New York calls. We can take your New Jersey and Connecticut calls. We can take your Florida calls for Dr. Dean at 646-435-7280, 646-435-7280. For biostatistics professor at the University of Florida, Dr. Natalie Dean, 646-435-7280. And let's take a Florida call right now. Here is Dr. Elena.
I'm on the radio now.
Yes, you are. Elena, hi. From Dunedin, Florida, right?
Yes. I'm board certified in preventive medicine and public health, and I called into our commission meeting where Pinellas County has 1 million residents, and so many people were not wearing masks. 40% of the 105 callers on this hearing the other day were similar to the one you played, where they were totally misusing science, misquoting it from a similar script they all seemed to have. There was one commissioner that we think was feeding people this script and used it herself. What concerns me is the huge gap in facts, that quote facts, that people are relying on here. And it's similar with the alternate facts in the country. But they're not realizing what the big announcement was yesterday, that there are 10 times more cases out there than the positive tests are showing. That the tests, the nasal swab tests, are only 70% accurate. So you can expect maybe 30% false negatives. That when wearing masks are considered to protect yourself instead of others, that's what they're doing with this. They're making it political instead of medical. And it's extremely disturbing that we need massive education and these people aren't listening to the same facts that medical... they had three experts testifying at this meeting, completely ignored by these callers. And then the Tampa Bay article the next day in the paper said the majority of callers were against the masks when it was really the other way around. Hmm. But that 40% of these people were believing this stuff was what was so frightening to me.
Do you find an age split there in the Tampa area? You said yes describe it.
Because most of the callers seemed younger. Even some young moms would put their 9-year-old kids on. They were in the 30s, 40s, I would say, but they were younger callers, all about their constitutional rights to not wear a mask. There were people about gun carry people who wanted to not have to wear a mask. They were saying it would keep them not able to protect their families by carrying a gun if they wore a mask. All of these issues were completely erroneous. The lawyer on the panel, the doctors on the panel, all of the facts, the real facts, were against this kind of fictitious science and bizarre paranoia. It was all politicized is what it was.
Doctor, I'm going to leave it there for time. Thank you very much for your call. We really appreciate it. So, Dr. Dean, I guess if you see the virus on the road, shoot it would be the solution for some of those people. But is it your impression, too, that it is that politicized in Florida, and to the extent that you think it is, it must be incredibly frustrating for you as a scientist, as a statistician, to see other things come into it to the degree that it apparently they apparently are.
I try not to go too much just what I see in the news. I think there is always an angle that people are more polarized than maybe they really feel. And the public polling I've seen is still reflects a support for masks. And but it, as there is a widening and where there are people who are not using masks for political reasons, I think we really need to find ways to kind of be people where they are and identify, not use scolding. There's a real public health precedent for like abstinence-only education for sex education for kids, you know, giving people sort of not scolding them and giving them information so they can make safe decisions and coming at it from a public health perspective and then really having support from leadership at the top that can demonstrate these good behaviors that can be replicated.
What do you make of the age disparity in the cases? The numbers that I've seen recently are that when testing got started, the median age for infection was 60, and as of last week, it was 37. If that's accurate, what does it mean?
I think it means a few different things at once. One is that there is more testing, and when there is more testing, you're picking up more of these milder infections that tend to be among younger people. We're seeing things like rollouts of workplace testing, so routinely testing younger people. And so those are going to pick up more infections. It may also be that we're doing a better job preventing nursing home outbreaks, and so that would tend to reduce the median age as well. But I do think also there does seem to be very real outbreaks among young people. And so where there's more infections among young people, that will lower that median age. But the question is whether that's not going to spill over into the high-risk populations that these young people closely interact with. And I don't know that that's sustainable. Where more people are infected in the communities, and it's more likely that it's harder for other people to protect themselves and stay safe.
Talia in Maplewood, New Jersey. You're on WNYC. Hi, Talia.
Hi. How are you? Thank you. Good. For taking my call, and love you, and my first time calling.
Glad you're on.
I'm, by the way, Julie Burstein's next door neighbor, so I feel...
Former great WNYC host. Go ahead.
Yeah, we have a good neighborhood here. Anyway, I'm just calling to ask if there are better treatments now that are preventing more, you know, a higher death rate. It's a debate that I was having last night with my mother, and I realized I didn't really know the answer. Are there less people dying because we've figured out some tricks?
Dr. Dean, what can you say?
So definitely we've learned a lot about this virus, and there are these incremental improvements in how we care for people, having more availability of, you know, oxygen, or having all the better tools. I mean, there's things like figuring out if someone should be kind of on their belly or on their back, or there's, you know, there are these different little things that help us understand better. In terms of treatments, you know, we've had some successes. There's a drug. So basically the things that were available are things we already had kind of on the shelf that were used for other diseases. And so there is an antiviral remdesivir that was evaluated and did have some impact. Recently, there were results from a clinical trial run in the UK that found that a steroid, a widely available steroid, helped people who were already severely ill. So it doesn't help people who have milder disease. It's meant to sort of help when people have this overreactive inflammatory response in their lungs. And so that's a real big success, because that's going to help. It's a widely available thing that can help people who are severely ill. But coming down the line are other treatments that look more promising. These include antibodies that have actually been manufactured that specifically for this virus because what we had before was just very general and we didn't have things that were targeted at this virus. And so those will start being evaluated in clinical trials within the next few months.
Do you think the spikes we're seeing in Florida, Texas, Arizona where it's 100 degrees all the time this time of year, are disappointing in the sense that it means this virus is not seasonal, that we don't get a break in a certain respect because it's summer around the country like we do with the seasonal flu?
Yeah, so there's really complex dynamics of what makes certain things seasonal, and we don't totally understand why certain respiratory viruses are seasonal, whether it has to do with the temperature and the humidity, or whether it has to do with people crowding indoors, as people spend at least in the, you know, the north, people tend to spend more time indoors during the winter. So, or it, sometimes these respiratory viruses are linked to school, when school is in session, and there are these sort of these known blips. So, you know, yes, I think it's not wholly unexpected that we weren't, just there's so many people that are susceptible, that don't have any immunity. And so in that way, it's easy for the virus to keep spreading. Maybe it will mean that we won't get a even bigger spike in the fall. It's hard to know, but certainly we should be preparing for the fall and winter as if we could see large spikes in places.
Bill in Yorkville, a doctor with a question about a Florida health official. Bill, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, how are you? It's great to hear your voice back in the air, Brian, and hi to your guests. There has been a really well-publicized issue, I think maybe a month ago, Rebecca Jones, who is a Florida Department of Health public official who was let go from her position, and the news story went that she was being asked to manipulate statistics in an unethical way on their sort of public-facing state COVID database. For you as a public health official or expert, what do you know, and this is kind of a wonky question, but what do you know about the compilation of, you know, COVID-19 statistics in Florida? In your opinion, where can we be turning for reliable information about this? I don't know really drilling down into the very specifics about the flow of information from positive tests reporting to, I don't know, state, local departments of public health, but where should we be looking as, you know, a reliable clearinghouse to even examine this information down in Florida?
Dr. Dean?
Yeah, so, I mean, one major challenge throughout this epidemic has been the lack of really standardized, centralized, reliable data sources. I mean, early on, there wasn't really any data available on testing, and so it took these volunteers to compile the data themselves, like the COVID Tracking Project and these other organizations. So, so there's been a real gap at the CDC in terms of preparing this data. So, I mean, so what we're doing is we're getting data just from the states, and then we're compiling it together, but without that same exact level of oversight from the CDC. But the COVID Tracking Project is external group, and they do, you know, they have a rubric and they evaluate the quality of data and from different states. And actually, Florida's been doing quite well in terms of data quality. I would say, you know, one of the big challenges with the data in Florida is there are lags. Although that's true in a lot of places, but there are lags in how things are reported. And so it can make the recent numbers hard to interpret. There are also unique things where deaths are only reported for people who are residents of the state. And Florida includes a large population that sort of split their time. And so you're only seeing a part of the picture there. So, I wish that we had more sort of standardized, sort of reliable information from the CDC.
And Bill, thank you for your call. Interesting and important question. You know, I see your Twitter feed, and I see that you write a lot about gender discrimination in the science community. Fewer women are quoted in articles as experts. When they are quoted, they aren't always given equal credit. There are fewer women on various COVID task forces. I could continue with the list. I'm curious, as we talk a lot here and elsewhere about the race and class disparities in COVID cases and COVID outcomes and COVID access to care, do you think sexism is playing a role in anything having to do with a virus that actually affects people's health?
Well, I guess the biggest indication of a problem with sexism in the COVID response and in the epidemic is what we're seeing in terms of the leadership and who are the people making the decisions. And when we have diversity in our decision makers, we end up with better decisions. And because it really, when the decision making bodies reflect who are the people who are really being impacted. And when we have more diversity, we have more creative ideas, and there's science to support that, we can end up with better results. And when we look at across different countries, and we look at sort of the leadership, and we see there are some, it's correlation, it's not causation, but we do see that some of the countries that are doing the best have female leadership. And if you dig into a little bit how they're functioning, one of the things, is they themselves are being advised by diverse groups. And so they have assembled diverse teams, and they're listening to the experts, and they're valuing that scientific expertise. And I really think that ends up, that is really net positive for those populations.
30 seconds left. What do you see as the biggest policy dilemma for Florida going forward, your state?
I think we need to be really serious in our discussions about when we might need to step back if things start to get out of control. And so we really don't want to end up in a dangerous situation like what New York has experienced. And we seem to be heading down a dangerous track. And what are we doing about it?
When to step back from the reopenings that have taken place.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly.
University of Florida biostatistics professor Natalie Dean. Dr. Dean, thank you so much.
Thank you.